Congratulations! You have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com. Greetings, listeners. When the Lambcast is available to you in a few more years, it will identify you by name, episodes you've downloaded, and have plenty of recommendations as to what to watch and what to buy. Until that time, you just have me. I'm your host, Richard Kirkham from Kirkham A Movie A Day, and this is episode number 712. It's Movie of the Month time, and reflective of the film, we have a minority of the podcasters available to talk about it today. November seems to be a slow time on the Lambcast this year. No lambs came to the field to graze for either November or December Movie of the Month shows. We only had three choices for November, and unless someone starts submitting some Christmas-themed movies for December, we may be getting a lump of coal in our stockings next month. However, when Bubble Wheat submitted Minority Report as Movie of the Month selection, our activity rose. We reached out to several lambs, and we found someone to join the show so that Bubble Wheat and I are not the only voices being heard this week. The 2002 version of Minority Report from Steven Spielberg was the first collaboration between Tom Cruise and Spielberg, and it was one that was highly anticipated. It was originally scheduled as a sequel to Total Recall, and the involvement of a variety of the actors and performers in the film changed over the years. Obviously, the film changed as well. The story changed quite a bit. We're going to find out about all of those things as we get started on this. But first, we're going to introduce our guests. To begin with, we have our resident curmudgeon, Howard Kasner, who agreed to join the show despite the fact that, he would probably prefer to have his eyes taken out rather than watch the film again.
I wouldn't go that far, but sometimes in order to see the light, you have to risk the dark.
That's right. We do have to risk the dark. And finding himself covered with crawling spiders, investigating his mere presence and the films that he promotes on a regular basis, we have Bubba Wheat, who is the champion of this month's film, Minority Report. Welcome back to the show, Bubba Wheat.
Yeah, it's good to finally win one of these again. It feels like it's been ages since I've won a movie of the month.
Well, we're glad that you did, and I think this is a good movie to talk about. I think there are lots of things about it that are very good. There's some things about it that surprisingly are very prescient, and then there's some things about it that I think make it feel very out of touch and maybe not quite as relevant as it seemed 20 years ago. But I'm going to let you lead the discussion. It's your film. You're the champion. You get to host. So take it away.
Sure, yeah. Like you already gave just a quick rundown of the movie. It came out in 2002. It was a pretty big box office success. It grossed over $350 million. And it's a Steven Spielberg movie. It's a Tom Cruise movie. So, of course, it had some big pedigrees coming out with it, and it's based off a Philip K. Dick novel, which I'm a big fan of a lot of these Philip K. Dick stories, Total Recall, Blade Runner, a lot of that interesting sci-fi stuff. And this, I remember, I don't remember exactly when I saw it. I'm fairly certain that I saw it whenever it came out in theaters, and I really enjoyed it, and I picked it up shortly afterwards whenever it came out on DVD as well, and I still have that DVD copy, which is how I watched the movie preparing for this podcast. So, getting into your guys' history, Richard, do you remember, did you see this whenever it first came out back in 2002?
I did, as a matter of fact, and I was just trying to remember. I'm pretty sure it was a summer movie, so I'm not sure what the release on it was
June 21st.
Yeah, there, that makes perfect sense. It was, in fact, a summer movie. And it was, that was actually a pretty busy summer, as I recall. There were lots of films coming out. This one was, of course, highly anticipated for the pedigree that you mentioned. Let's face it, it's a Steven Spielberg summer film coming out in June, and it stars Tom Cruise. That's in 2002, that seemed like it was a pretty good advertisement for seeing a movie in a theater. And I was impressed with it. Philip K. Dick, the only book that, of his that I know that I've read is, you know, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? My daughter, my oldest daughter, she decided not to go to graduate school in English. She was an English major as an undergraduate, and she was thinking about pursuing a PhD. Her thesis idea from the very beginning was about Philip K. Dick, so she would have been a great add to the show. But this is my older daughter who has, you know, disdain for technology, so the idea of doing a podcast with me is not going to go over well. My younger daughter, she might have done it if she'd had a little bit more time to prep for it. But like the older one, she would have been very happy to talk about Philip K. Dick, and she'd have lots of insights about the themes in the story and about how the changes were made to the story and all those kinds of things. I don't have any of that, unfortunately. I just have that experience, and I remember enjoying the film quite well.
All right, and Howard, I've already got the heads up that you're not a big fan of this movie, but did you see it whenever it first came out?
Yes, I did. I mean, it was Steven Spielberg, Tom Cruise. You're not going to pass it up if you can help it. I'm sort of a fan of Philip K. Dick, only in that I've never read anything by him, but the stuff adapted from his work, I like these ideas that he's dealing with, these existential ideas. Here it's more free will versus determinism, though they come to the wrong conclusion. But it's also, many of his themes are like, if you can't tell the difference between a human and an android, is there really a difference? So he's a very existential writer, and I just like his ideas.
Yeah, and this is, I think this is interesting because this was, I suppose, after Total Recall, this was one of the first, like, big successes, because I know, I believe, Blade Runner was not a big success whenever it first came out, and it's developed a following years after. But I believe that Total Recall was a success whenever it came out, and then this one was as well. And I feel like both Total Recall and this do take a more action movie approach, and the existential and philosophical debates are there, but they do kind of take a back seat to a certain extent to the action. And I'd like to.
Very true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially in this one. I'm sure we'll be talking about that, but there's a lot of chasing and running going on here.
Yeah. One thing that I didn't think about, and I actually watched this movie for the first time, about a month ago, was the similarities in the overall plot, especially with the chase sequences between this and The Fugitive.
Oh, yeah, Fugitive is the basis for a lot of plots.
Well, I think that whole sequence, for instance, where he is in The Fugitive, where Richard Kimball has gone to the jail to, you know, interview one of the people that he suspects could have been involved in his wife's murder, and the Gerard and the marshal's office shows up, and then a chase ensues, and there's a parade and a crowd, and he's trying to disappear into the crowd. I saw the same kinds of things going on, like you said, in Minority Report. We get a sequence toward the end where, you know, two people are trying to hide in a crowd. It's more complicated because of the technology that's going on there, but some of the basic techniques are the same. The use of an umbrella, hiding behind a balloon, it really did feel quite familiar. The only thing that was missing was the green dye in the river there.
Well, the basic idea of The Fugitive dates back to Les Miserables, because that's really what the television show was based on. Harlan Ellison, that was one of his biggest complaints about movies and television shows. And he wrote an essay on it, that they were all based on The Fugitive. And he thought that was not his favorite kind of structure. And that's why movies were so bad.
But I do think that this does have some fantastic chase sequences in it. So, let's start out with, I think, the opening. Well, yeah, I guess it's not so much a chase sequence in the opening, but what do you guys think about the actual opening sequence, this introduction to the whole precog system in this future system with Tom Cruise's character, John Anderton, going through this, deciphering this this precog vision in order to try and find the correct house and when it's going to take place under a short timeline.
Well, it feels a little bit like a CSI episode where they're taking bits and pieces of information and trying to put it together. Like you said, we're trying to create a location. What's the direction of the light at this time of day? Are we near a park? Is the door open? Those kinds of things. It feels a little bit, like I said, like a very typical procedural thing that's all being condensed into a short amount of time. The thing about this film that is different, of course, is the way the technology is being used to put all this together. I'm still waiting for this virtual reality where I just stick my hands out in the air and start moving things around to actually occur. I'm sure it's happening someplace in the world, but it's not happening any place where most of us are seeing it. And I remember a sequence, there were very elaborate sequences like this in a film called Disclosure with Demi Moore and Michael Douglas, where they had the same kind of technology that they were using. And then I remember this film came out, and I said, oh, this will be great. We won't even need a screen in front of us. We'll just, reach into the air and move things around, and we'll, the touch tablet is still a thing. That's still going on, but this invisible touch tablet in front of us, maybe some of the technology is being used in military applications for pilots flying planes, but it doesn't seem like it's something that's gotten down to the consumer level yet. But the way people...
Well, I think there is a bit of gesture with, like, the Apple Watches.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah, I can wave my hand at the phone to take a picture. There's something like that that works. We're going to get there eventually. I guess the film is set in like 2054, 2056, so we still got 25 years to get to that point. Maybe it'll all happen. But I
do think that's the one thing that it does get wrong in terms of that is the whole physical media. Even though it's all glass, it's every data is transmitted wirelessly everywhere. Yes. Nowadays.
Yeah, everybody's got the little glass disc that they're using, or they've got some card that they're inserting into a thing. Although the wireless thing does come up later on, because let's face it, the identification issue with the eyes is happening everywhere, and that was creepy in 2002, and that's our life now. You go online and they're watching you.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a great move for us to look at this future technology and what it gets right and what it gets wrong. And I do think that basically this idea in 2002 of targeted ads, basically, where there are these iris scanners everywhere, and you are being given targeted ads with all these billboards and these visual billboards that they say your name. Which that really does feel like the targeted ads that you get on social media, where there has been a large number of targeted ads to me where it has like a personalized t-shirt and it has it uses my last name or my first name inside a meme, and it's targeted to me on Facebook, which is really kind of weird, but it really feels like it came directly from this movie.
I'll give you the creepy one that I get. I get the name one on a regular basis, both first and last name, it's a Richard thing or the Kirkham family emblem or something like that. Here's the one that I find a little disturbing. I lost my wife a few years ago. I get messages about remembrance kinds of things, t-shirts or plaques or pictures about being a widower and trying to sell me something based on that. And that just feels a little icky to me. And I know it's just they're just data mining.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think the other creepy ones is whenever you just talk about something to somebody else and then you get a targeted ad of what you just spoke about.
Yeah, it doesn't take
Yeah.
long.
I think the opening scenes both show what works and what doesn't work about the film. I love this technology where they can predict someone is going to be murdered so they can stop it. I think that it's incredible technology. If we could only get that technology, how the world would change. And I also find it interesting the technology you're talking about, where they have it, they have you personalized, so they send these ads to you. One of the things that doesn't work for me in the opening is so convoluted and so arbitrary. Oh, we have three psychics and we've raised them to be able to only predict murder. They can't predict any other crime, even though in a commercial someone talks about rape, but they can't predict that, even though they say it in a commercial. And it beggars all sorts of legal issues. And the movie eventually comes down against this technology, and I'm going, are you kidding? This is great technology. If you could do some, if you could change a few other things, this is incredible technology that I wish we had. And the movie makes all sorts of philosophical and legal mistakes during it. So I think the opening is both great, but it also shows the shortcomings
Well,
of the movie as well.
I'm going to jump in here with a couple of observations about that. The technology, the first question that occurred to me when we were talking about this particular technology, not all the other things in the film, but this pre-crime prediction of things, is this replicable? Because you're basically dealing with
Yes,
three people
exactly.
who were affected by their parents using drugs while they were pregnant and producing this particular kind of effect, and it makes them sensitive to the most violent kind of emotions, which is what murder is, and that's their explanation about why it's only murder that they can predict. And I'm going, and they're about to go nationwide, and I'm going, how do you do that? How do you manage to find, are you going to do this deliberately? You're going to get people pregnant for the purpose of producing these precogs in order to then enslave them, in essence, into a swimming pool for their entire lives for the purpose of producing this kind of data. That seems to me like a bigger issue that you'd have to resolve than the legal issues that are coming up. The legal issues, here's the thing that I think probably would solve a lot of these problems. Instead of treating it as if people had committed the crime that is prevented, you have some other kind of legal consequence for them. Maybe the halo thing that they put on, but not for life. But for a period of time, it says, look, you almost committed this crime, and we're going to punish you for almost committing a crime, but we're not going to treat you the same as if you had killed somebody because you haven't. There is a problem with the equivalency thing going on here. So I think that might have been a legal way that somebody would have come along and suggested, let's modify this a little bit so that it doesn't have the same ramifications that you have under the traditional legal structure. But like I said, the technology thing is the thing that bugged me the most. I'm going, how is this
Yeah,
going to go
I mean,
nationwide?
you're
There's
really
already
hitting on the issues I have with it. Not only am I thinking, how can you make this nationwide? Because they can't possibly predict all the murders that are taking place in the US. You also have to factor in the fact that it probably wouldn't make a difference to the majority of emotional murders where someone just murders someone. If if that would happen, then having the death penalty would make a difference in that. It just doesn't work that way. But also, these are adults. These precogs, they're adults. They're slaves.
Yeah.
Something has happened to the judicial system that has, one, allowed adults to be turned into slaves without their knowledge, without their agreement, that also has allowed them, as you say, to be punished for a crime they didn't commit. You can be punished for attempted murder, but you can't give the same punishment as actual murder if it's only attempted murder. And this awful prison that would be considered inhumane, violation of the Constitution in and of itself, because it's such inhumane treatment. And all these ACLU seems to be going after is the process, is the end result, is they want to just get rid of the pre-crime. And I'm going, no, that's the legal, that's the only legal thing that's happening here. That's the only really good legal thing happening. They go to these judges, they get a warrant, and they go out and stop these people. So the ACLU isn't even focusing on the right thing. In addition, if everybody seems to have had their eyes put on the system, that is also a violation of the Constitution. In real life, your fingerprints and your DNA are only on the system if you've committed a crime, maybe if you've been in the military, but that's a separate thing you have to search for. So the idea that everybody has this eye recording, I'm going, where is the ACLU on that? Because that is definitely
This could be
a violation.
I'll give you the storytelling explanation on this, and that is that everybody's eyes are being recorded by whatever technology is being used and for commercial purposes, and the government just has access to that database, and so that's one of the things that allows this to happen.
Hang on a second.
The violation that comes later is when they've got all those little spiders going in and checking everybody, and we're going to eye, you know, and and we're going to do a retina scan there and figure out if you are one of these people that we're looking for. That, I think, is maybe a lot more problematic, especially when they can go into your apartment when you are, you know, on the toilet, in the bathtub, making love to your spouse, having a fight in the kitchen, and you're going, hey, wait a second, where's the Fourth Amendment in this particular situation? There are, you know, search and seizure laws, and the Fifth Amendment, you know, against self-incrimination. There's just a lot of stuff that's going on here. There are legalistic issues. Now, of course, we've seen that the world changes quite a bit. We could talk about the way the technology didn't pay off here. Let's talk about the way the social system didn't pay off. We're going the opposite direction of what, you know, this is kind of predicting a totalitarian thing where people are pursuing security. We seem to go in the opposite direction where we are emphasizing less security and more people's rights. We're more concerned with making sure that people are not abused by the government than the other way around. So I think they got that prediction wrong.
Yeah. I mean, you're so right about the spiders. I'm watching that scene. I'm going, oh, my God, what are they doing?
Yeah, there's definitely the incorrect, you know, the civil liberties that are being violated of everywhere in this movie in so many different ways, and even so much that, like, it's very subtle, but they present, like, the other pre-crime officers as being not really very good at their job because they're so focused on the pre-crime aspect that whenever they're presented with a real crime, they don't even know what they're doing. Like, there's that one brief line whenever Danny Whitworth asked the second in command guy, like, where he came from, and he said that he came from financing or from, like, the Treasury Department, and he's never actually worked a homicide before.
Yeah, It's a different world. Oh, and by the way, since we're talking about all those kinds of things, let me just add one more. How is it that he gets to stroll into Tom Cruise's apartment, seize evidence without a warrant, and use that as a way to make decisions about, what's going to happen? I'm going, something has happened in this world that has caused things to change that we're not seeing.
Yeah, there's definitely these unanswered questions that the movie is not interested in answering for us, and so that it's more focused on posing the questions that it wants us to focus on while also delivering these action sequences, and it wants us to pay attention to the action and even like the comedy to a certain extent. And I do remember that the first time watching this, I thought that some of the comic beats were a little off-putting to me. I think the big one is in kind of the second chase sequence after right after the spiders, whenever he is trying to get into the precog chamber, and he is grabbing his old eyeballs out of the plastic bag. And he drops them and goes on a very cartoonish chase sequence and just barely catches one as it is about to fall through the grate. I definitely felt that was a little bit off-putting in terms of what we're supposed to be feeling at that moment in this like moment of tension, and to a certain extent, we're rooting for him to get to Agatha and to
I think
solve
you're right.
this mystery.
And another just a little plot hole thing. It turns out that the reason he wants his eyes is because they do retina scan to get access to the interior, the precog headquarters. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm sorry, he's a wanted criminal. The very first thing they would have done would have closed off that access. My daughter Amanda lost her job at the end of July. They told her at 12 o'clock on a Monday that she was done. She couldn't log into any of the accounts 10 minutes later. She was logged out of everything. They had taken her out of every meeting that she was scheduled for that week already. It was one of those things where they were getting rid of people all over the place, and it was, 10 minutes after she was let go. She had no access to anything on the website for the company that she was working for. Can you imagine if you were a law enforcement officer and you were wanted for this pre-crime or this pre-crime murder that's going to be taking place, in addition to the other violations that they think are going on here? But we're not gonna clamp down on security on the most important part of our system here. That that's I'm that that's just look, we'll probably pick out a whole bunch of plot holes as we go along. However, it's an exciting sequence, so I like that, and it is a little bit of a laugh when he pulls the eyeball out to use it that way.
I think the other bit that's a fun moment with the eyeball that I actually did like is at the very end, whenever his wife, we
Oh,
see
yeah.
that he ended up using his eyeball to gain access to the the jail system.
Yes, exactly. So there's a payoff to that whole setup that they have there. Why does he want the eyeballs? And we get two justifications for it later in the story, even if they don't quite make sense. Yeah, and by the way, his eyeball gets him access even after he's in prison. That's a little weird, but that's
Yeah, I
okay.
will say that's the other big chase sequence, which I think was very fun and inventive at the time, is the whole chase sequence whenever he has Agatha with him and she is telling him exactly what he needs to do because of her future sight. And I think that was a really fun and well done sequence to show her telling him to do things, and then he does it without question, and you don't know what why she's telling him to do that until just
take
a
the
few
umbrella,
moments later.
Turn left, you know, stop, yeah. wait.
Wait for the balloons. Wait for the balloons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that worked really well. It was an interesting sequence, and it made the whole chase thing a lot of fun. I thought it was a little hackneyed to have the jetpacks in the chase in the earlier scene. And, you know, I'm still waiting for my jetpack. You know, I've been waiting for that for 40 years. I knew that they were going to show up someday, right? You know, and we'd all have our individual flying units, cut down on the traffic. Forget Segway. I need that. But that's not really a thing. And I still don't think it'll be a thing.
Yeah, every time I get into a discussion about flying cars, my first thought is, you know, how many accidents are there with driving cars right now? How much worse do you think it would be if people can actually use flying cars?
Yeah. Now, the technology that is accurate in the film, to some degree, not the way the cars drive, but the way they're up. We've got a lot of autonomous cars that are driving themselves. You know, the people in the car are not really operating the car themselves. And Tom Cruise is jumping on the cars at one point back and forth. And you can see the people inside, they're just, you know, having conversations or sitting in the vehicle. And the cars are controlled by outside technology, too. The cops can shut down the car that you're in. We're not too far from that. Almost all new cars have this computer technology, and they're talking about tracking people based on the miles that they drive and taxing you that way rather than, you know, taxing you on the gas. We're going to tax you on the miles, that kind of thing. So we're not too far away from some of those things happening. So that part of the technology is right. But again, criticizing the futuristic part of this, you know, and it looked really cool, and some things obviously have paid off. The idea that cars would be driving sideways up and down the sides of buildings, No. That makes no sense whatsoever. California can't get a freaking train online after 20 years. There's no way that they're going to be building roads where people can, you know, drive sideways vertically. That just isn't going to happen.
Although it did look cool.
Yes, it did. It did. And once again, it makes for that cool sequence where he's kind of leapfrogging from one car to another. You know, I think we'd have to be several hundred years in the future. We'd have to be more like Fifth Element time period rather than just 50 years in the future.
Yeah, 2054, I believe, is the time that it's supposed to take place. And that also has another one of those very silly comedic moments whenever he crashes through the window and his legs fly over his head, and then he's in the future yoga with the contortionists doing extreme yoga.
Yeah, that's pretty damn extreme yoga. That was creepy. And apparently they hired contortionists for that, you know, to make it look like this is an everyday sort of thing. Yeah, whatever. You know, the old saying, kiss your ass goodbye, and all these people can do it.
Yeah, I just recently saw a short video from one of the talent show type reality shows. Uh-huh. And it was a contortionist that was, you know, bending over backwards in that same way, and then the host that was standing next to him, you know, thinks that he's slapping him on his butt. But he's actually, because he's bent over backwards, he's slapping him right on his crotch. And he's like, oh, my God, I thought that was your butt.
Yeah, you know, like I said, they put in little bits and pieces like that to kind of give us a little bit of humor and a little bit of maybe a different world that we're operating in. And it's definitely a different world. But we had plenty of big things that indicated that as well. So I'm not sure that that was necessary. But I didn't find it distracting. Just, whatever.
And then I think the other big thing to talk about with this movie is the overall mystery. You know, we have two mysteries going on at the same time. We have this murder that John Anderton is supposed to commit that he doesn't know anything about. And there is that little bit of a causality loop where the reason that he's that he's going to commit the murder is because he was told that he's going to commit the murder. And so there's also the actual titular Minority Report with the death of Anne Lively, and how LaMarge Burgess, the Max von Sydow, the head of the father of the pre-crime division, is the one that murdered this woman by using what he knows about the system to make his actual murder look like an echo of the predicted murder.
Well, it's the appointment in Samaria type thing, where the prince sees death in the marketplace in his city, and death looks at him very oddly. So the man thinks that the reason why he's looking at him oddly is death is coming for him. So he takes off to the city of Samara, where he runs into death, and death says, "The reason I was so surprised to see you in that other city is because I knew I had an appointment with you in Samara the next day." And with that, death kills him. So it's the one thing that you're doing to prevent events from happening is the one thing that is causing the events to happen.
Yeah, the whole issue of causality is one of the things that makes the movie interesting, because, you know, we talked about determinism also, but what is the cause? Is the cause in this particular case the fact that it's been predicted? How do you avoid doing something like that? That gets complicated. John Anderton basically says, "I'm not going to do this. This doesn't make any sense." But of course, there's manipulation that's going on, and we find out that the manipulation that's going on in the whole thing is designed to cover up this other element of what's happening here. I was looking back a little bit. I thought maybe we should automatically just assume that Max von Sydow is, got evil intent or responsibilities here, because that seems like it's a typical part for him. And I'm not exactly sure that is true. There's a little bit of that from some of those 70s kind of conspiracy stories that seemed like it was exactly what we were talking about. But I can't find any other particular examples where, he's the bad guy, the anonymous bad guy, the hidden manipulator behind the scenes. It just felt like maybe that's the way it was supposed to be.
He played a lot of bad guys, though, in 3 Days of the Condor.
Yeah.
He even said that because he had the Swedish accent, that's why he was put in a lot of bad guy roles.
Yeah. It's exotic, and so that makes it easier for him to play. But he did a lot of science fiction films. And this is,
like he had to pay off taxes. I don't know what it was.
Well, he's otherworldly. Like you said, his voice is part of that, but also his looks. He's a tall, lanky guy, and in this particular case, he's older. I'm not sure how many years after this did he live? Another 10 or 12?
Something like that.
He worked up until the very end of his life. He was making movies. I know he was in the first of the Star Wars second trilogy, or whatever you call them, the last set of Star Wars films. I remember seeing him in that.
He lived another 18 years after
18
this movie.
Years, yeah, there you go. Thank you for doing the math on that.
Long enough to get one more Oscar nomination.
Yes, that's right. Oh, that was for that not good movie.
I know. The one
but he was good.
They had Take a Child to Work Day.
Yes. Ouch. Ouch.
Yeah. But I think he and Samantha Morton give really fine performances. I really wasn't impressed by any of the other acting, but I think Max von Sydow and Samantha Morton steal the movie, acting-wise.
Yeah, so Samantha Morton was fantastic as Agatha. I mean, she does spend a lot of the movie just kind of staring up into space and inside a milky pool. But whenever she does get taken by Tom Cruise and she does go through this. She does have a lot of great moments, and even though I feel like it's a little bit of emotionally manipulative, I do still like the moment whenever she's in John and his ex-wife's house, and she is having this like
precognitive vision. I think when you say it's manipulative, I think it's the kind of thing that we need to have, because obviously John and his wife have gone through this tragedy. It's motivated him to do all of these things, some of which are not particularly good things, and it's kind of a moment of redemption and comfort for them to have had this imagined view of what would have happened with his life. I like that idea. Maybe it's manipulative, but I was willing to be manipulated in that situation.
Yeah, I do also like how they do present John Anderton as an imperfect character, because they do give him this drug addiction and this focus on the loss of his child, and the fact that he was kidnapped and in a public pool, and that is like, I can't even begin to imagine, even though that's, you know, whatever you look at it, that is an extremely rare case, that, you know, that's not something that is a very common occurrence. It is like an extreme rarity, but just to think of that situation and the guilt that he must feel as a character to have gone through that, and how everyone does keep bringing that up, even Colin Farrell's character, he uses that as a form of manipulation, even though his character does have a bit of redemption towards the end, whenever he begins to realize that this is a setup, and then he goes on to get murdered by Lamar Burgess whenever he gets too close to the truth.
Well, what else did you want to talk about? We've gone all over all kinds of things here. Howard, tell us your reservations about the film a little bit.
Well, we've covered most of them. I think the last one that I have is the ending, where they shut down pre-crime, which is not going to happen for the reason they say it is. The only reason why they would shut down pre-crime is the courts won't allow them to use these people, since they're adults and they're basically slaves. They're not going to close it down because someone manipulated the evidence. If that were true, we wouldn't be using fingerprints, we wouldn't be using DNA, we wouldn't be using all sorts of other things. So, and I think in the book, they don't close it down. In fact, Anderton saves it, and it should be saved if possible. Just because someone sets someone up and lies about it, no one's going to shut down a program because of that. If there's something inherent in it, like a lie detector, where you just can't trust the results no matter what, that could be shut down. But this would never be shut down. It's too valuable. It works. It would keep going if there was a way to do it with those precogs that was legal.
Yeah, I also do have a problem with the ending for that exact same reason, because I feel like they got the right ending, but they got it in the wrong way, where I didn't like the fact that that Lamar Burgess kills himself instead of John Anderton at the end, and that everyone gets it almost felt like the Wayne's World super happy ending, where, you know, John gets back with his wife and she's pregnant, and then the three precogs are living in a cabin out in the middle of nowhere, where they have a happy but isolated life. And I do think that it really does skip over too much the fact that these three people are being used against their will, and they're being kept constantly in a drugged state, so they're constantly half awake and half asleep. And it, there is just a little bit of, at the beginning, John Anderton has the line, you know, it's better if you don't even think of them as human. But then we do get these moments of once Agatha gets out of her drugged up state, she is able to have a normal conversation and she is able to speak and she does have agency. And there's not quite enough of a focus on that. And I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, they're treated like the slaves in the 1800s. It's better to not think of Black people as human beings. It's, you know, you just don't think of them that way, that they have agency or anything like that. So I don't know what Supreme Court allowed this to happen, but I get a feeling there's been something that happened in this society, or that the writer just didn't care. They thought, oh, it'll be so interesting that people will overlook this. And there was too much for me to overlook. The other small thing, it does have to do with the idea of, do we have free will or are we determined? And no one gives the right answer, which is that it's irrelevant. It doesn't matter if we have free will. It doesn't matter if we're predetermined. It's impossible to live life without assuming we have free will, whether we have it or not. So you can say all you want that everything is predetermined. We can't exist that way. It's impossible for a human being to exist as if he doesn't have free will. So, and they don't quite get there philosophically.
And then there is one other scene that we haven't really talked about. It is a bit of a brief scene, and in a way, it's almost inconsequential. I feel like that this almost could have been cut out, but the scene with Dr. Iris Hinneman, the mother of the precog, and all of her CGI plants and the exposition.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. We're going to get some of the background on what happened and how this all occurred, and we're going to do it in this weird greenhouse where, you know.
So it'll be less boring.
It's full of strange things that are going on, and I'm not exactly sure how the tea cures him of the poison that he's been injected with, but apparently it makes a difference, and I'm glad that he doesn't die halfway through the movie chasing after, you know, killed by a Venus flytrap. That would have been a little bit anticlimactic. But she's an odd person too, and you know, she acts as if she's, you know, the mysterious, insightful, like she's got precog as well, you know, that she can tell what's going to happen. And maybe there's something that's going on there. The way that she and Lamar, you know, took responsibility for this and then kind of separated in the directions that they were going on it, and that she just, you know, I'm surprised that he didn't eliminate her.
Yeah, she just removed herself from society entirely because of what she did to create the precogs, which that's just like this small plot thread that they tuck inside this scene and don't really give a whole lot of weight to it. The fact that they were trying, that her, she was trying to help these, I mean, for lack of a better word, crack babies, is like future crack babies on that were born of mothers of this future drug, and so they were basically more or less it seems like they were born brain dead or born in a vegetative state, and they were trying to cure them, and then in trying to cure them and help them, they ended up creating the three precogs. That's how I understand it.
See, the way you've described it is the attempt to address the issue that Howard has. How do we enslave these people? You know, that sort of thing. And the answer is they aren't really enslaved. They're in treatment. It's the treatment that they have to get in order to control their impulses and the nightmares that they have involves, you know, taking those memories or those visions and, you know, kind of putting them someplace else. But of course, we also discover that they keep them. They don't get rid of them. They're not extracted and removed. Maybe they're chemically manipulated. So that might be the, like, if we were going to go into the script and try and fix all of the problems that we've been talking about, that might be the path that you could go by and say, okay, well, they're not enslaved, they're in treatment, and we're just taking the residual benefit of this treatment and using it in a productive way. That's how I think they might try and get away with this. But I don't know, like, in the world that we live in, it's not really realistic.
Yeah, I think that they were trying, like, they didn't say it, but they were trying to show that they were basically wards of the state, that their parents signed them over to the state.
Which you can do until they're 18, and then you can't do that anymore legally. I would have just had someone have created a computer that he invented this algorithm that does it. Or, and that takes away almost every issue.
I saw a few episodes of that show, Person of Interest, where that's in essence what they have, is they have a computer program that kind of predicts crime, when it's going to happen, who's likely to commit it, and it becomes, it's really like the prequel to this story. But I didn't watch the show regularly. I saw it a few times in its first season. I heard it was very good. But we do have technology that uses algorithms to kind of predict where the police should be deployed when it comes to crime. So we do have some of those technologies. This is just a little bit more specific to a particular kind of crime, and it's a little bit more unique. The human element of it is the thing that, of course, makes it kind of interesting, and the motivation for the conspiracy has to be the exploitation that's going on here. Lamar is basically, taken possession of this program and use it the way that he thinks it's going to work best. That Howard's perfectly happy having, it's going to solve it's going to solve the murder thing, and that's all a great thing. A lot of things that solve murder that we don't put up with, and this would be one of the, this is an example of it. Instant execution for people for certain kinds of crimes would probably solve murder pretty much as well, but we don't allow that. We don't allow cops to just shoot somebody on the basis of suspicion.
It doesn't work shooting someone instantly, because most murders are crimes of passion.
Well, lots of murders are crimes of passion. That part is true. I forget what the percentage is. It's pretty high. But when we say they're crimes of passion, most of the crimes that are committed under they're drug related. Either people are under the influence of drugs, or they are warlords trying to gain control of the drug industry. That's a huge chunk of the kinds of crimes. But those aren't the ones that people have traditionally, watched mysteries and murder mysteries about. They aren't really just about that kind of thing. They're about, for-profit kinds of things or revenge kinds of things. Yeah.
The pre-crime thing they do here, if you can get over the slavery, is perfectly legal. What isn't legal is they're not getting a trial. They're being punished for something they didn't do, as you mentioned.
Well, here's the thing.
This inhumane.
Because they do have it in the story that they in essence do have a trial. The witnesses are the two other people that John gets on the Zoom call with, and they all observe the precog vision, and then they look at the little rolling ball and say, "Yes, guilty," and go execute them.
I didn't take them as doing that. I thought they were giving approval, like judges do with warrants, to go after this person.
Yeah, but it's not just the warrant, because it is also the, as we've determined, the crime is already, they've predetermined that the crime exists or will exist. And so
you can't punish for someone like that.
That's what the whole story's about. Can you do that? And they've apparently decided that we can. And they've created a judicial system for doing that, and that's what you know, LeVar Burgess is trying to do, is trying to get this universally approved. And there are people who resist this idea.
That's my point. We're actually agreeing here that there's something wrong with the judicial system. I'm saying there's nothing really wrong with the pre-crime element. That's perfectly okay if you can get over the slavery. What isn't working is, as you say, there's something wrong with this judicial system. And the pre-crime would be a great thing to have, like DNA and fingerprints, if the judicial system wasn't fascistic, like it seems to be in this story. But that makes sense, that there's a distinction.
Yeah, in a parallel universe, there's a version of this movie where the pre-crime police, instead of going and arresting the perpetrators before they commit the crime, they go in and offer counseling to the perpetrators to understand why they're committing the crime and to basically give them support rather than arrest.
They do have a line in the movie at one point trying to explain why sometimes the window is so short. You know, and sometimes it's 3 or 4 days, and sometimes it's really short. And that's that it is a crime of passion, that it occurs only after certain events have occurred, and until those events have occurred that produces the emotional reaction of people, the crime wasn't even going to happen. It's you know, if somebody is planning a robbery and they're willing to murder people in that, well, that's, you know, premeditated. But well, for the opening example, the scene that we talked about is one of those things that's, like we said, it's a crime of passion. The guy finds his wife in bed with somebody else, and you know, he's emotionally overwrought, and he's going to kill them. He's going to kill them. We've seen the precogs have figured out that he's going to kill them in this particular situation, and luckily they get there in time to stop that from happening. But it's a short window between when, you know, we know that a crime is going to occur and when it occurs. And that, I think, is, you know, that would have been a rich territory to develop also. Maybe a little bit less of the chase stuff and maybe more about this. This is not an intellectual film in the long run, although it raises a lot of those questions. It's really an action film filled with interesting technology and great things to look at, with some weird off-center characters. We didn't mention Peter Stormare's character, you know, the underground eyeball extractor. I kind of thought that was an interesting sort of thing. And we've got the
which that was another scene that had a lot of the bizarre comedy and also some gross outs, like the fact that he's introduced with just this
snot coming out of his face.
Snot dripping out of his nose.
Yeah, they do things in the movie to make it strange and unusual and interesting, but not necessarily things that make a lot of sense. So that's okay.
Yeah, especially how he's so willing to help this guy that put him away, but he just had, as long as he's able to get just his little bit of revenge in there with the rotten food and the good food mixed in.
Yes, it's like, I did the right thing by you. The fact that you couldn't pick out the good stuff from the bad stuff, that's your fault. Well, what else did you want us to talk about? Did you have any other talking points that you wanted to get to?
I think we've pretty much covered it. So, I mean, there was a TV series in 2015 that only lasted for one season, but I didn't even remember that was a thing. I only read about it after the fact, so I don't really know too much about that. But I'm curious if they did try to go into a more intellectual direction with the TV series, and maybe that's why it failed. But who knows?
Yeah, I have no memory of it whatsoever, the TV series. That seems strange. I'm sure that they probably spent money on it, but like you said, nobody. It didn't last what, a whole season? I don't even know if it ran a whole season. Sometimes those things come and go very quickly. And, Nowadays, they at least let the series run through its episodes on Netflix. All right, well then we can kind of wrap up the discussion. Do you want to do lamb scores for this? Or do you care?
Sure. I mean, I'll gladly give my lamb score for it. I mean, I do love this movie. I have some issues with it for sure, but I think overall it's more of the movie is enjoyable than not. It's a good action mystery thriller, I think, that raises some good questions and also raises some bad questions. But overall, I would give it a 4 out of 5.
All right. And Howard, how about you?
And I'm afraid that the questions override everything else for me, so I couldn't lose myself in the you either go with it or you don't go with it, and I'm on the didn't go with it side. So for me, it's 2 stars, 2 lambs.
All right, 2 lambs. And I'm going to go kind of right in the middle between you guys. I'm going to go with 3.5. I like the ideas that the film is bringing up. I think there are interesting questions here. I don't know that it makes a lot of sense the way this has worked, but it's a science fiction premise, so I'm going to give it a little bit of leeway on those things. And some of the action stuff I really liked, and some of it just I didn't care for. That extended chase sequence, the one that included the jetpacks, seemed to me to be a little bit over the top. And it's just one of those things. It's a minor issue to me, but I found the film very enjoyable, so I'm going to go with 3.5. All right, we're going to take a brief break here, and then we'll come back for some rants, raves, and reviews in just a minute. But first, we're going to hear from a fellow Lamb Podcasting Network show.
Hey, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Abe.
And together, we host Out
Now with Aaron and
Aaron and
Abe.
Hey, we pulled that off.
Hey.
This is a weekly review show, right? We talk about movies on a weekly basis.
And other things.
Yeah, we have commentary tracks, we have lots of guests.
A lot of bonus episodes, a lot of game talk, a lot of sports talk.
Yeah, somehow sports talk factors in there, along with Simpsons references for whatever reason.
So give us a listen. We're everywhere podcasts are found.
Yeah, they're everywhere, right?
Everywhere.
Out Now with Aaron and Abe.
Coming live.
Sometimes?
I think it's
in there. I think I can edit that together.
We're back, and it's time for our rants, raves, and reviews of the week. We didn't have an exit question planned, so we're just going to give people a chance to talk about what's on their mind. Howard, what's on your mind this week that you want to share with us?
Well, I think I will just sort of rave about 2 TV series that I've seen lately.
Sure.
They're both on Netflix. One is Into the Night, which posits that something's happened to the sun where it's sending only gamma rays, or it's sending gamma rays. So whenever anybody comes in contact with the sun, they die. So a group of disparate people do end up on a plane, and they have to figure out what to do. They have to stay in the dark, and then they have to figure out what to do. The other one is Bodies, which is a mystery that takes place in 5 different years, all starting the same way. This body, this naked body, and it's the same body for each time period, shows up naked suddenly out of nowhere in a alleyway in London.
This sounds like a time travel story.
It is.
All right. Well, it's time to rewind. What's all that about? You know? Something in your future there, Bubba Wheat.
Yeah, maybe.
What are you going to be talking about this week?
Well, I haven't been watching a ton of stuff, but the most recent thing that I've been watching and been enjoying is I've gone back to start over watching a classic sci-fi comedy series, Red Dwarf. And that's been a lot of fun. I got introduced to the series whenever it came out on DVD, and I've owned the first 5 series on DVD. And I am, even though I do still own them, I am currently watching them on Tubi. where it has, I believe, all of the seasons and even the more recent ones that came out just a few years ago. And it's been a lot of fun going through that series again from the beginning. There's only 6 episodes per series, and for the first several, I don't remember if they have any longer seasons later on, but I'm finished the first 4 and have started the 5th one, and it's a lot of fun. It's if you haven't seen it, it is definitely low budget, but I really enjoy the premise of it's kind of the odd couple in space to a certain extent. You have Lister, the slob, and Rimmer, the uptight hologram. And that's set 3 million years in the future. And Lister is basically the last man in existence. And it's really interesting. They have some good time travel episodes and take on a lot of interesting sci-fi concepts in a funny way.
Well, you know, I've been hearing about this show for years and years and years, and most people that have talked about it, I have been saying positive things about it. I've never watched any of it, but I'm gonna, if it's on free on Tubi, it sounds to me like I could invest at least a couple of episodes, see if it's for me, and give it a shot. So anybody else out there who's in the same situation as me, you should give it a shot, because if I'm going to do so, get off of my lazy butt to do it, you can do it too. All right, well, I'm gonna review briefly a film that I saw last night that I really enjoyed, and I saw some comments online today about it that I completely disagreed with, so I thought it would be worth maybe taking a couple of minutes to talk about. I saw the David Fincher film The Killer with Michael Fassbender in it, and I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. It had a very methodical process to it. It's filled with narration, which is usually something that should be a warning to people, but I thought that the narration worked really well in this, because it's really kind of the internal monologue of the character that we're following. We don't really know anything about this person except what he tells us, and I appreciated, you know, kind of being led through that. The other thing that I liked about it is that it's a slow burn. It reminded me a lot of a 1970s film. As I'm watching it, the first part of it takes place. It's about a paid assassin who's, you know, killing people, and something goes wrong in the current assignment that he has, and this is all the fallout that happens after that error in activity that happens. But as I'm watching the first 15 or 20 minutes of this film, it reminds me of the first 15 or 20 minutes of The Mechanic, which is the 1970, I think it was 72, film with Charles Bronson playing basically the same kind of character, where he's studying and watching the person that he's been assigned to kill. He's figuring out how to do this, and there's it's basically long periods of silence, lots of observation, and that was the thing that people were complaining about that I saw online today, that it was slow moving, that it was boring, that you didn't care about anything that was going on, and I had the exact opposite reaction. I thought it was fascinating, the detail that goes into this, how each little element becomes part of a person's system for accomplishing something, that you stick to the system and you make it work for you, that something can go wrong. Look, something can go wrong anytime for all kinds of reasons, and it's not necessarily the fault of the system that you have. And I don't think, you know, I don't want to be rooting for a paid killer, but in essence, you know, that's the only character that we have in this film to root for. Everybody else is reprehensible. So, you know, we've got one reprehensible who's dealing with a bunch of other horrible human beings, and at least we understand the motivation of this person and why they are acting the way they act. And they're given a little bit of motivation in the film for some of the subsequent things that they do. It's pretty violent. There are 2 or 3 sequences that involve, you know, a lot of viciousness, let's say, that come along. And there are some actors in the film that I think people will be slightly familiar with, some that you won't be familiar with, but the tropes are all very familiar. The idea of this paid assassin, you know, trying to disappear into the atmosphere. One of the things that also made me think of it as being a 70s-based film is that all of his aliases come from characters from 70s and 80s TV shows. So the people who don't recognize those names, they're obviously not my age, because everybody would know who some of these character names are. They'd be commenting on it, but they just slip by here in the film, and I thought that was kind of amusing. You know, when somebody presents his credit card and it's Archibald Bunker, I thought that was worth a laugh. So I would recommend the film, but only if you're a patient film watcher, somebody who likes a slow burn and can appreciate, you know, like I said, an interesting take on a well-worn trope. All right, well, that's our show this week. We appreciate Bubba Wheat for, you know, championing Minority Report to the Movie of the Month status for November. Do you guys have something that you want to promote before we take off?
Well, I suppose I can go through it again, because, you know, we're recording this on the same day that we recorded the previous one. Maybe I'll go through a lot quicker, though. The Pop Art podcast that's up right now is with Lisa Leahy, where we did The Ring, the Chris of the Demon. That's the Halloween episode. I'm working on editing now Sean Homrig, where we did The Ice Storm and Peyton Place. Then I just recorded Jennifer Van Sile, where we did Parasite and Lost Ceremony. After that, you, Richard, where we're doing The Candidate and Bob Roberts. And then Jay Cluett is doing the Christmas show again. And we're doing Wind, Chill, and Dead End.
All right. Bubba Wheat, you got something you want us to turn our eyes and ears to?
Sure. I mean, my big podcast that I think promoting the most right now is Fight Club Minutes. It's been going on for a few weeks now. Episodes come out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and each episode we discuss 1 minute of the movie Fight Club, you know, another David Fincher movie, just like The Killer. And that's been a lot of fun. We are, I believe, whenever this comes out next week, on Thursday, I'll have a special bonus episode where I interviewed Bob Stevenson, and he played a very small role in the movie, but he was the security guard in the airport who stopped the narrator because his suitcase was vibrating, and it's usually an electric razor, but sometimes it's a dildo, and that was him, and I got to talk to him about that scene. In Fight Club, and it was a lot of fun. So you guys can check that out. And on my other podcast, It's Time to Rewind, every Tuesday I am discussing one of the dates from the 2004 comedy 50 First Dates with Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore. And that is a very different movie from Fight Club, but it has also been a lot of fun discussing that, breaking that film down date by date.
That's a really good idea.
Nice, nice. Oh, let me remind people also that you can vote for Bubba Wheat's slate of films on the Fantasy Film Draft, but you don't want to do that. You want to vote for my slate of films on the Fantasy Film Draft. The poll is up there right now. We had a discussion on an earlier episode of 1980s fantasy films. Four of us on the show each drafted a slate of 6 films, so we got 24 films that if you haven't seen yet, you're going to hear something about. I'd also try to incentivize everybody to not only listen to the podcast, but you can watch the podcast on YouTube. And I've spent a little bit of time and energy putting together these videos, and I feel pretty good about this one about the Fantasy Film Draft. So if you haven't listened to the podcast, watch it instead and enjoy it that way, because I think you'll enjoy the visuals that go along with our talk about the films. I want to thank Bubba Wheat and Howard for being flexible enough to adjust to our schedule this week, and I appreciate once again talking about Minority Report. I can't exactly, you know, I'm not precognitive. I can't tell you exactly what the future holds, but I do know that it involves a lot more schedule changes in the next couple of weeks. Thanks, everybody. All right. We'll be right back.
listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell.
Be careful, it could go off for like no reason.